There had been abuse in my family, but it was mostly musical in nature.
Are you ready to get your world rocked?
Ready!
Are you ready to get your mind blown?
Do it!
1, 2, 3, 4!
Indie rock pioneer Bob Mould has experienced all the ups and downs of rock and roll life, and he's lived to tell about it. I'm Greg Cott of the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis from WBEZ and Columbia College. We look back at the end of Husker Du and the beginning of Bob Mould's solo career. Plus, we review the new album from producer and rock innovator Brian Eno. That's coming up on Sound Opinions. From WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX, you're listening to Sound Opinions, and time now for some music news.
That is Party Rock Anthem by LMFAO, the most popular tune on the Spotify music service. Spotify, we've been talking about it for a few years on Sound Opinions. It debuted in Sweden in 2008. It is finally here in the United States, a long, arduous journey to get all the licensing cleared up. Those were the big hurdles here. It had to get the big labels behind it. Now, interesting question here. Here is a service that was perfectly willing to pay artists and labels to make digital music widely available to consumers, and yet it took them 3 years to get here. They are finally here with a three-tier plan. One is to offer free ad-supported music to consumers. You can test it out without putting any money down. Then there's a basic ad-free version for $5 a month, and then your premium service for $10 a month that allows you to access your music on your mobile phone, also higher audio quality and other perks. Now, in the time that Spotify has been trying to clear all these licenses and get artists paid, you've got services like Rhapsody, RDO, and Moog already doing that in the United States. So can Spotify create a niche in the United States the way it has in Europe, where it dominates 10 million registered users, 1.6 million of them paid subscribers? It remains to be seen, though, with all the competition here, whether they can make the same kind of impact in the United States.
That is Head Like a Hole from Nine Inch Nails' 1989 album, Pretty Hate Machine. What a great track, Greg. But Trent Reznor, the guiding light of Nine Inch Nails, is apparently not so happy with a reissue of Pretty Hate Machine that came out some months ago, but he just recently tweeted, it got under his skin. Mm-hmm. He tweeted, Nine Inch Nails fans, don't waste your money on this version of Pretty Hate Machine that was just released. A record label BS move repackaging the old version. Ignore, please. Always interesting when you see a star of that caliber, someone who sold so many records, saying to his fan base, don't buy this version of my recording. Obviously, still proud of that record. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the repackaging of an artist's work often does not take into consideration what the artist wants in any way, shape, or form. They sign these contracts, and buried somewhere on page 97 in fine type is that we have the right to reissue and remarket and put out new versions of your material. Now, some bands have no problem with this. U2 seems to be very happy with an upcoming 20th anniversary reissue of Achtung Baby, a deluxe package. Says The Edge, there's some interesting alternate versions we discovered that wouldn't have seen the light of day. wouldn't have seen, but doesn't that mean shouldn't have seen? It wasn't good enough the first time. But Paul McGinnis, U2's ever industrious capitalist manager, says, quote, if you pile a lot of extra material and packaging and design work into a super duper box set, there are people who will pay quite a lot for it. Man, how greedy can you be? Nirvana, you know, it's been 20 years since Nevermind came out. We're going to see a deluxe reissue in September. 4 CDs and 1 DVD. This is a band that recorded 3 albums before Kurt Cobain died. Where is all this extra stuff? There's some BBC radio stuff. There's some rarities. Never mind, there's already been several Nirvana box sets and several rarities collections. You and I both super fans of this group. I can't imagine there's enough to justify this.
This is why the music industry is in trouble, Jim, because they do stuff like this to consumers. They make them rebuy stuff that they already own again and again, in some cases for exorbitant prices, just to get that one or two tracks that might actually be worthwhile. But those other 28 that they're piling on, yes, there was a reason they weren't issued in the first place.
Let me repeat what Trent tweeted. Ignore, please.
You think I got time to blow all this dough and do all these shows? On flight in the llama charging white gloves. Uh-oh, another episode.
Do I do?
To everybody that be living it up, we say.
What I do?
And all my ladies that be giving it up.
That's Ja Rule's Living It Up. Remember Ja Rule? Kind of a prominent hip-hop artist in the late 90s, early 2000s. Had a huge album with The Last Temptation. Also starred in several Hollywood movies. Then disappeared. What's Ja Rule been up to? Well, he's doing time, apparently. Sad story here. Just sentenced to 28 months in prison for failing to file federal income taxes for returns over a 5-year period. Apparently, he owes the federal government about $1.1 million on over $3 million in income. That's on top of an earlier prison sentence. He's been sentenced to 2 years after pleading guilty to criminal weapon possession. So the judge took pity on Ja Rule and said he could serve the sentences concurrently, but Ja Rule is going away for a couple of years.
Also going away, Greg, sad to say, is the Borders Books and Music chain. It was a 2-part folding of that company. They closed down a bunch of stores a couple of months ago, and now it's officially out of business. Time had an interesting piece, Time Magazine, about why it failed. 5 reasons. It was too late to the web. It was too late to e-books. It opened too many stores. It had too much debt. 5, most interesting for our purposes, it overinvested in music sales. It had lots of music stock, and nobody's buying CDs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a victim to 2 revolutions in the digital technology, both books and music, and I think a real loss for American consumers.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and that is the Husker Du classic New Day Rising from 1985,
one of a series of incredible albums the band recorded under the leadership of our guest this week, Bob Mould. The singer, songwriter, and guitarist has a new book out called See a Little Light, The Trail of Rage and Melody, that traces the highs and lows of his career and his life. From growing up in rural New York to struggling with his sexual identity and alcoholism, to forming one of the most influential bands in rock and roll. Husker Du released a succession of significant albums in an incredibly short period of time. Zen Arcade in 84, followed by New Day Rising and Flip Your Wig, then Candy Apple Gray. They never became a household band, but you can hear the legacy in countless other groups, including Nirvana, The Foo Fighters, R.E.M., with Mould on guitar, co-songwriter Grant Hart on drums, and Greg Norton on bass, the band took punk velocity and pop craftsmanship to superhuman levels. But the personal relationships proved to be toxic. There was competition, there was addiction, there was egotism, It's for that reason that Mould rarely discusses Husker Du, but he sat down with us in the studio to look back at this time and to talk about dissolving the band and then, just as important, going out on his own. It was a really dramatic period with the final album, Warehouse, in 1987, and then Bob Mould's nervous debut as a solo artist in 1989. So we started by asking Bob if he saw the burnout coming with Husker Du.
I didn't see burnout coming. I mean, to go back to that really prolific period, you know, with Zen Arcade, New Day Rising, Flip Your Wig, I grew up on 60s bands. You know, I grew up on the Beatles, who put out albums every 6 months. You know, the transition to Warner Brothers and sort of how that changed the dynamic of the band, I think that is more important than any kind of burnout factor. Grant Hart, the drummer and the other songwriter in the band, you know, Grant and I could crank songs out pretty quickly. When you get to Warehouse in the summer of 86, fall of 86, the conception and recording of it, you know, I think what used to be very healthy competition for the greater good became, you know, it became rather contentious. And you know, in the book, I touch on a couple things. Let me make an analogy. When Husker Du was a smaller band on an indie label before the spotlight, you know, we were just it's like this flashlight was on a band and you're all clustered together closely and, you know, you're sort of in the light together. And, you know, you get a floodlight like Warner Brothers and, you know, the lights spread out and people can scatter. People can try to get in the front of the light at the expense of others. And I think it's natural. It's not like, wow, you know, we were really competing consciously. That's one part of it. There was a lot of passive aggression going on between myself and Grant. You know, I made what in hindsight might have been sort of not a fatal error, but critical error. When we were recording New Day Rising, Grant presented a song called 2541. And we were playing it, and I heard it, and it sounded exactly like another song by contemporaries of ours, the Dream Syndicate at the time. 2541, big windows to let in the sun. 2541. And I pointed it out and said, you know, maybe we should pass on this one. And I think the song meant a lot to Grant, as witnessed by, you know, it was his first volley after the band broke up.
Yeah.
And one of his best songs, you know. So, you know, maybe by saying that, I had sort of started a spiral. You know, that's how life works with everybody. You say something, a little bit of toothpaste spills out, and all of a sudden, you know, you really can't brush your teeth anymore. Going back to the period, the conception of Warehouse, and everybody's making some big life changes. I was 25 years old. I had been drinking every day for many, many years.
Since you were 13, right? Or 12?
Yeah, since I was 13. I realized I had to stop. And in this business, that can really change the dynamic of a band, where a person stands in the community, all that kind of stuff. Greg made some changes, too. Greg was withdrawing from the band as well. He had gotten married, moved down to Red Wing, which was about an hour southeast of Minneapolis, opened up a record store, and started living a very different lifestyle. You know, where I think he was swinging a golf club more than he was a bass guitar. Mm-hmm. Grant got a new guy in his life, got some, you know, started hanging out with some other bands that maybe weren't the best influence to be around, and he made some choices. I didn't know about those choices until much, much later. I was pretty blind to things. You know, I had my hands full at the beginning of 1987 when Warehouse came out. There was a, you know, our person who worked with us in the office, David Savoy, you know, committed suicide on the eve of the Warehouse tour, which was pretty lousy thing.
It hit everybody in the indie rock world really hard, because in the early days he traveled with you. Everybody seemed to know him. I knew him.
Yeah, Dave was a great guy. And I did not handle it really well. I just went into panic mode, and it was not good. Hmm. I think Grant had already, you know, in hindsight, I know his new habits were already in effect at that point.
Well, and just to be clear, we're talking about heroin with Grant,
yeah,
and alcoholism with you.
Yeah, yeah, I was clean by then, and so I was sort of dealing with it, you know, right in my face, and yeah, I handled all that really badly. But so life goes on, and then, you know, we sort of have to take 2 weeks to regroup and then go out and do this big tour around the country to promote this double album, which was more or less two solo records.
Mm-hmm. It seemed like, as you said, the competition was between you and Grant for space on these records. This was pretty much close to a 50-50 split, if I'm not mistaken. Did you find yourself contributing less and less to Grant's songs and vice versa at this point? Was there absolutely no input, or how did that work at that point?
We had become such a machine by that point. We'd get our basic tracks down, and then I would do guitar solos, and if we needed to fill in more space with guitars, I'd add stuff. And then Grant would take it away and do whatever he was going to do to it, and if he wanted background vocals, he would say, "You want to sing on this?" And I'd come in and do something. And I wasn't in there a whole lot when Grant was doing his tinkering, so I didn't know what was going on. And I knew he was spending a lot of extra time in the studio trying stuff. You know, I was a little more workmanlike. I just wanted to get it done and get out of there.
Mm-hmm. Because basically you and Grant were co-producing the record. Steve Fjellstedt was engineering.
Right.
But you were running the ball. Here you are making a major label double album, and you still had an incredible amount of control over the kind of music you were putting out, which is pretty rare, it seemed like.
Yeah. You know, we were feeling subtle pressure from Warner's on Warehouse. They wanted a cleaner sound. You'll get a situation where, like, the head of the AOR department will go to your A&R person and say, you know, Karen Berg, if you go to this band and you just tell them, you know, tone the cymbal noise down a little bit and just get the vocals up higher, I mean, we're going to sell a million records. Karen Berg was an incredibly gifted person in the music business. Her passing was really, a few years ago, was a very sad, sad occasion. Her history in the business, and she was a publicist at Elektra and worked with Joni Mitchell and, you know, all, I mean, Elektra was such a pivotal label in the industry. And then, you know, she went over to Warner's and, God, she worked with Television and B-52s, Marshall Crenshaw. She signed REM. But she was getting pressure, too. And she had to bring it to us. I mean, that was her job.
I think for younger listeners who don't have the context, it's important to remember, you know, why did they sign Husker Du if they didn't want him to sound like Husker Du? But there was this uncertainty before the alternative explosion about what could come up from the underground into the mainstream. Well, REM had done it. What's the matter with you guys? You
know? Yeah, yeah, yeah. And this is before the internet. This is before a lot of things that we take for granted now that are just part and parcel of how we digest and access music. We had to try to do what we could do to not compromise our vision, but to conform a little bit. And that's just the way it was in 1987.
Could you be the one they talk about? Well, hiding inside behind another door. Well, is it all the happiness you want? Just wanting a feeling better anymore. It doesn't mean that much to me sometimes. I don't mean that much to you. And I don't even know what I'm hiding for. And I don't even know what I'm hiding for. I don't even know what I'm hiding for.
We've got more with Bob Mould coming up on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. But first, we want to remind you to leave your sound opinions on the air. Talk about Husker Du, Bob Mould, or anything in the rock universe at 888-859-1800.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. You've been listening to our conversation with Bob Mould. He's got a new book out called See a Little Light that chronicles his life and career as a member of Husker Du and Sugar, as well as a solo artist. And in each incarnation, he's been hugely influential in the rock world. But we specifically wanted to talk to him about this dramatic shift from being a singer, songwriter, and guitarist in Husker Du to going out on his own. Now, along with Grant Hart on drums and Greg Norton on bass, Husker Du worked at a frantic pace. I mean, you think about the series of albums they produced between 84 and 87, including Zen Arcade and New Day Rising, and they seemed to be on the cusp of mainstream success once they signed to Warner Brothers Records. But within a couple of years, by early 88, the band was no more. Bob Mould had walked away. Now, he would reemerge later on with success, but there's no denying Husker Du's dynamic when it was at its peak. What I was hearing, Bob, is especially seeing you guys live, you had this guitar sound that you sounded like three guitar players.
Yep.
And Grant was not a timekeeper in the traditional sense. He was more, I heard more of a jazz drumming approach.
Absolutely.
With him. A lot of crash cymbal, and that's where you're talking about, this kind of very splashy high-end thing.
Yep.
That was going on, right?
Riding the crash cymbal, a sound we would soon.
Yeah.
Hear with this other band from Seattle.
Oh, right? Yeah, yeah, you think?
Mm-hmm. Nirvana, oh, yeah.
Do you think,
okay,
Dave Grohl ever... Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah, I mean, Grant had a great style. Also, he's a big fan of surf music.
Mm.
A lot of sort of agitated ride, you know, getting up on the bell and then really getting the heat going on the ride cymbal at the key moments. So, I mean, yeah. Yeah, it was very much, the band was Autoglide, and it was like this chase all the time. You know, if Grant picked it up a little bit, I'd want to get ahead, then he'd want to get ahead, and then, I mean, that had a lot to do with this, with the speed of the band, you know, and it just kept picking up and up and up. Around New Day Rising, when we started writing the more contemplative songs, there were moments where things tempered and came down and were more solid.
Then the sun disintegrates between a wall of clouds. Summer where I winter at, no one is allowed there.
And then I think around Candy Apple Gray, you really hear a change in the band, you know, and Warehouse, where it was a little, you know, everything was sturdier and wasn't quite as risky and brisk and, you know, sailing along like it was early.
Mm-hmm. In reading the book, See a Little Light, your autobiography, it seems like it sort of hit you at once. It wasn't apparent to you that Husker Du was going to end, because you're already projecting towards the next record. You were thinking about producers. Then there was that incident on the road, late 87, show in Missouri, right?
Yeah, it was Columbia, Missouri at the Blue Note, yeah.
And it was clear that Grant couldn't play.
Yeah. We did a North American tour for Warehouse, and then we went over to Europe and played a lot of festivals and big rooms over there. We came back and we had the summer to put together what would be the next record. We saw a break, and that was when we started to write for the next record. You know, we got together and the rehearsals were terrible. I was bringing in songs and nobody was responding well. Grant was bringing in stuff and, you know, I would just be like, what are we doing here? But, yeah, we went out in December. We did this final tour. We went to St. Louis, and that's where stuff started to get sort of wonky.
Hmm.
You know, some woman showed up. I guess she brought Grant some methadone or something. Again, all this is new to me. And then this is the point where there's about 36 hours where I'm not really clear what's happening. I talked to everybody that was around, and I got a different story from everybody that was there. And this was one of the frustrations of writing this book. But the short story is that, you know, something went on in there, and somebody came to me and said, you know that Grant's been using heroin. And I was like, really? I had no idea. I had no idea.
But that close and working that intensely for that long.
I mean, I had my suspicions because of the people he was with, but I thought, come on, Grant's a smart guy. And then I'm just like, oh. Then we get to Columbia, Missouri, and terrible show. We've got through the set somehow, went upstairs, and we're just like, what's going on? And Grant fessed up, and I was just like, I said, do you think you can make it to tomorrow? And he's like, yeah. And I'm thinking, no. I said, we got to get this thing. We just got to take this thing off the road and go home and take some time. Spent a few more weeks trying to figure out what to do, and then we called a meeting, you know, it happened at Grant's house with his family. And in the book, you know, people will see the story, and it was a sort of a sad end. And that was the moment where I just sort of said, I gotta get out of this. I called up the band's attorney and said, I want you to file the leaving member papers with Warner Brothers. I am officially done.
Must have been a stunning moment for everybody. I mean, here you were on another level. You were at this cusp of success. Everybody was said, this is the, you know, the next big band. And at the same time, you felt it was so dire, you had to walk away from it, which must have been an incredibly lonely feeling in a lot of ways, saying, okay, yeah, I'm going to step away from this and do something completely you didn't have any idea what you were going to do at that point.
I had no idea. And just to establish this fact for people, that singular incident was not the reason Husker Du ended.
Right.
I don't think it's fair to put that kind of heat on Grant. What I think happened is it was the culmination of 18 months of people really drifting apart. That was only a period at the end of a very long sentence.
Prepare the swords and hammers and several bags of nails. Well, I could build a wall to lean on, roof above my mind, but I can see you got your own plans. Please don't drive your nails into this heart of mine.
We're talking to Bob Mould. I'm Jim DeRogatis. I'm with Greg Kot about his new book, See a Little Light. Bob, can you see from this point in history, you know, I mean, Greg and I have to really fight. It's rare that we're in this studio that we have to fight to be professional. But when we sit here, Husker Du meant so much to the two of us in our formative years. I mean, that was the band. Michael, who wrote the book with you, this band could be your life. Your band was our life.
Thank you.
Can you see from this perspective why that band meant so much to people, why we carry it as importantly as we do?
I think Husker Du was the best band ever, at least in the 80s. I don't think there was anybody that could touch us on any night.
Yeah,
we prided ourselves on being the best band, being a responsible band, being as professional as we could be inside of all that chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an incredible run.
Well, it was the physicality, the aggression, the violence, just the, you know, it was all out all the time. Mm-hmm. There was no let up. And then the silence. You're up in the farm.
Wow.
In 1988, yeah. And yeah. There's nothing. It's quiet. The band is over. Talk about doing a 180.
Yeah, from that crazy cacophony to total silence. I had bought 10 acres of land. I had an old brick farmhouse and some outbuildings. And I basically went up there and just sat. And I, you know, had to do a lot of soul searching and trying to find a new way to express myself. In 87, some of the songs that I had written that didn't see the light of day, obviously, at that time, you know, I was thinking about strings, I was thinking about cellos, I was thinking about horns, just different ways to broaden the, you know, the tonal palette. Now left to my own devices, I could experiment with those things.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the nonsense I tried, the one that resonated was the cello. The cello is the instrument that is the closest to the human voice because it breathes and it has that vibrational sound like a windpipe.
Mm.
So that was the one that I started building songs with. You know, I bought a new guitar. I bought the Blue Strat, which is my go-to guitar to this day. That guitar really opened up a whole new world for me. That and a 12-string guitar that I'd bought in Boston.
Mm.
I started messing with a lot of alternate tunings. And I remember a point, Dave Ayers, who worked at Twin Tone, and I played a couple songs for Dave. And he said, have you ever heard of this guy named Richard Thompson?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Richard Thompson's an amazing player and composer, just one of the real legends of contemporary music. And I had not heard Richard's stuff. I was not familiar with Fairport Convention. I was not familiar with any of those records.
How old are you at this point?
27.
Yeah. Wow.
And I said, no. And he said, well, and then he like started playing me stuff, you know, all these songs. And I'm just sitting there like, oh, great.
I'm ripping off this guy I've never heard before.
So I was a little self-conscious, but, you know, I thought about it and I just said, what am I going to do? Bag this new thing that I'm really excited about because it sounds like this other guy a little bit, you know? So go with it and, you know, listen to the records and then just continued on with the writing and creating of the foundation for Workbook.
You were inventing a new way of playing music, it seemed like, going from that power trio thing to the solo approach. Bag of Dimes, you call that tone that you were getting on the 12
string. Yamaha 12 string, yeah, because it was just sort of janky. All the overtones that I was used to, you know, with the Distortion Plus box that I used in Husker Du to get all that overring, now I was getting it out of just sort of playing hard on this 12 string guitar, and I was like really fascinated by just the amount of shimmer and sparkle that I could generate, you know, without using any pedals. I would say probably Brasilia was the one that really had the overring.
People were stunned when that record came out. I don't think anybody expected Workbook out of you.
Definitely a different artist.
Talking to Bob Mould on Sound Opinions. Two questions I always wanted to ask about Workbook, Bob. Number one, what the hell is Brasilia Cross with Trenton about?
I
love that lyric.
I woke up one morning and literally wrote that thing in the shower. Mm. It was like dreams that I had had the night before. I talk about the no buildings over two stories high, obviously. You know, that refers to the farm and just the downtown of Pine City where I lived. It was, you know, just one of those traditional, you know, sort of mercantile, one flashing stop sign in the middle of this town square kind of town.
And the feed
store. Yeah, the feed store. Yeah, it was literally just the reciting of a dream. That's why there's such a simplicity to the music. It's only the three chords. If I wanted to dig in a little bit, you know, Brasilia is these dreams of exotic places, but you end up in Trenton. You know, and no knock on Trenton, because I ended up there many, many times.
Question I wanted to ask was about that band. It seemed like you'd put so much thought into it. Anton Fear had been the drummer for the Feelies in New Jersey and had played with the Golden Palominos, and, you know, he was a monster.
Herbie Hancock,
Miles Davis.
Rocket.
One of the only white drummers ever to play with Miles Davis. And Tony Maimone, such a virtuoso from Pere Ubu.
And I was such a fan of them, too.
Unbelievable. Oh, and Jane Scarpantoni on cello, too. These were all virtuosic musicians, but they came from the punk world, and they had the avant-garde sensibility. Yeah. It almost seemed to me as if, like, talk about your dream team, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And also in 89, when touring, you know, the first time around was Chris Stamey.
Right.
You know, from no slouch TVs. Himself.
He played with Alex Chilton, an incredible guitar player.
Yeah, and Chris was, you know, Chris had one of the early synthesizer guitars, so he was playing the cello lines on some of the songs, you know, when we played live. I was very fortunate to surround myself with some great players. Anton, again, had been suggested for producing the Huskers record that never happened. Mm. And he suggested Tony. And, you know, that was a great rhythm section to build with. And Chris and then Jim Harry, who came in and played guitar later in the year, who was at the time creating RuPaul Supermodel in his loft, you know, over by Port Authority. So it was, you know, we had a lot of, it was a great time, a lot of great players. And
was that a different feeling to have that
power behind
you?
Well, I mean, hold up, Anton's playing to Grant's. Yeah. They're both amazing drummers, but it's a completely different feel. Anton will throw a house at you if you try to speed up.
Yeah.
You just feel it on stage. Yeah. It's just like you just feel like you're going to get hit in the back of the head with something, which was so opposite from that rushing back and forth with Grant. Tony was just this meat and potatoes player, and his job was to watch Anton's right foot. Mm. So that every time he stroked a string was the exact moment that Anton kicked that bass drum. Husker Du didn't play like that. Yeah. So it was just, it was, you know, instead of this, you know, this race to the finish, it was this slow, steady, methodical, powerful approach. And when the low end is in phase on stage like that, it's just rumbling. You know, it's not like a, it's the difference between a plane taking off and, you know, an earthquake happening. It's really a different feel completely. So, yeah, I mean, I learned a different kind of power with it.
You also opened the album with an instrumental, Sunspots.
Yeah.
Finger picking.
Yeah.
Another thing, acoustic finger picking.
Yeah, I'm not so good at that these days, but yes, I was good then.
But it set you up because you started doing acoustic shows as well around this time. You did one in California, I believe, in that first go-around.
McCabe's, yeah, that was the first time I ever did that.
So talk a little bit about that. I mean, you taught yourself a lot of stuff in this year, and the finger picking was just, I'm going to pick this thing up and I'm going to teach myself how to do it.
Yeah, I felt like I was like not a good player because I couldn't do it. You know, I'm just like, come on, people learn this playing banjo in, you know, grade school. Why didn't I pick up on this? There was no finger picking on the first Ramones albums. You know, so I guess that would be my excuse. Yeah, it was a way to try to branch out a little bit, and it's an avenue that yielded some nice results, Sunspots in particular. It's an avenue I didn't get too far down, you know, because I quickly went back to just bashing the thing, you know, a couple of years later. Mm. But it was a real curveball, and I knew by putting that at the front of the record, it was very much a statement of intent.
Did you feel any different? I mean, take us back to your first shows with Husker Du and now your first shows as Bob Mould solo artist.
The first show at Maxwell's in 89 with this band was the most terrifying show of my life. At the beginning of Husker Du, I had no idea what anything was. Mm. You know, all I was doing at 18 was emulating the things I loved and I saw. You know, I was emulating the Ramones and the Suicide Commandos. A couple years into Huskers, I sort of got my focus and realized that I could change things with music. But go forward to 89, people had not seen, they had heard Workbook, they had not seen Workbook. Mm. So, you know, when I went up on that stage, I'm 60 pounds lighter. I've let my hair grow a little bit. It's a whole new sound, and I didn't know what I was doing. I was scared out of my skull.
So in the book you write about this period, we're coming out of this big transition. We're talking about late 89 now. You moved from Minnesota to the East Coast.
Yeah.
I'd closed up a six-year relationship. You'd ended the relationship you had in Minnesota.
Yeah.
Left the town where I'd lived for 11 years and fallen in love with someone new.
Yeah.
Who would be your partner for the next decade or so.
Yeah.
And put out a solo record that, hey, people liked it.
Uh-huh.
They actually accepted you as a solo artist.
Yeah.
At the end of this, you must have felt like, you know, as the book says, see a little light. Maybe there was a little light at the end of the tunnel
definitely.
For you.
I mean, personally, I'd gone through a lot in 89. You know, the making of the record took me out to the East Coast. The farm was sort of, you know, I just felt so isolated up there. I wanted to be with Mike, so I put the farm up for sale and moved back down to the building he was living in a different space, and very quickly found out that he had already created a new life for himself and I was not going to be part of it. And once we closed that up, within a week of formally closing up our relationship, I had no band in Minnesota. I had no partner in Minnesota. So I just picked up and moved to Hoboken. That was where I was meant to be. You know, within 3 weeks of being single and hanging out at Maxwell's every night, I met a fellow named Kevin O'Neill. We met one night and joked about how neither one of us wanted to be in a relationship, that they were terrible. And, you know, by the next morning, we were in a relationship. So and that was the beginning of 14 pretty wild years.
Mm.
You know, wild ride through Sugar, through solo records, through Dog and Pony, through Modulate, and then boom, that ended. But, you know, I went from, you know, this isolated, what am I going to do existence to making this pretty great record that redefined who I was and was the real beginning of my own career.
Baumhold, once again, it is an honor and a pleasure to have you on Sound Opinions.
Thanks, you guys. Thanks for having me, as always.
To hear our 2008 interview with Baumhold, visit soundopinions.org. Coming up on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX, we visit the Desert Island. And Sound Opinions drinking game players, get ready. We're going to review the latest from Brian Eno.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and I am pleased to announce that we are about to talk about Brian Eno yet again on this show. It is Jim's hero, we all know. That's a track called Glitch from the new Eno album Drums Between the Bells. It's a collaboration with poet Rick Holland. Eno does most of the work here. He's doing most of the instrumentation. He's doing some of the vocals. He's brought in a few guest vocalists to read the poetry of Holland. He was primarily interested in Holland and the text and the possibilities that that offered from a sonic standpoint. More than 20 solo recordings by Eno. How do you summarize this man's career in a few short sentences? But the short story is Eno went to art school, minimally trained in music, revolutionized a art rock band out of England called Roxy Music alongside Brian Ferry, left that band to pursue a solo career. His song-oriented, vocal-oriented records, Here Come the Warm Jets and Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy in the mid-70s, were mind-blowingly great. Then went on to make a series of instrumental recordings, ambient music as he called them, concurrent with that, working as a producer and collaborator with Talking Heads, debut of Devo, the David Bowie Berlin Trilogy, U2 in the 80s and 90s, most recently with Coldplay. He's been collaborating with that huge British band. The new record is called Drums Between the Bells, Brian Eno and Rick Holland. Here's a track from it on Sound Opinions.
All over London, the clicker of seed pods against passing buses.
Is Eno with a new album, Drums Between the Bells, on Sound Opinions. And Mr. Kot, All that blather up top about, you would think I'm a slavish devotee of Eno's.
You're now, not?
Well, I champion Eno at his best. I have never said Eno is infallible. It's interesting that this is on Warp, because there are so many children of Eno making more innovative music for that label now than he is himself. The problem with this record is, if we just had the instrumentals, and it's Eno really playing everything himself, including the percussion as well as the synthesizers, I think I'd be enjoying it a lot more. But having these people, I gather these are all people in his everyday life. I don't know if it's his mailman or the laundry woman or whatever. He had them read these poems of Rick Holland, which are all about coming to terms with the alienation of the digital universe. Okay, that's a subject I'm down with. But the red poetry versus the interesting instrumental backings doesn't really work for me. This is a guy with an incredible voice, and he seems at 63 to be afraid to sing anymore, and he has been saying in interviews how he hates lyrics. I don't think there's anything wrong with a pop song, and he's spent his life helping other artists make really interesting ones, but he seems hesitant to make them himself anymore. This is a perfectly okay album. On the Buy It, Burn It, Trash It scale, that puts it at a burn it.
Wow, Jim, without an unqualified endorsement of a new Eno record, I am shocked.
I've been mixed before. Yeah. I'm a critic here.
Well, there you go. You're acting like a critic, and I got to say, I agree with you on this. I don't think it's Eno's best work by a long shot. I do hear elements of the record he did with David Byrne decades ago, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, where they would take those preachers that they would hear over gospel radio stations and integrate them with their own music. He's doing something similar here, where he's taking these very deadpan readings of this poetry about the alienating effects of technology and using it as a sonic element. It's an interesting experiment. There are moments where it really works well. There are other moments where it's a little bit dry. And you're right. They're not vocalists, and you can hear that, and you wonder what a real vocalist or somebody with a real personality might have been able to bring to these tracks, like Eno, for example. But I do like what he's doing with the drums, and I would love to see him do a little bit more work in this rhythmic area, because I think that's the most interesting part of this record, the way he warps and glitches some of those rhythm tracks. But as it is, on the Buy It, Burn It, Trash It scale, it's a burn it for me as well.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
Remember, we were shipwrecked together.
As often as possible here on Sound Opinions, we like to take a trip to the deserted island and play for you a track we can't live without. Greg, what have you got to add to the Desert Island Jukebox?
Jim, I've been thinking about the hip-hop career of one of Chicago's most exalted rappers. That would be Common, a.k.a. Lonnie Rashid Lynn. How great he used to be. Not so much recently. There's been a little bit of a fall off. I think Common's been concentrating on the Hollywood career. But I was listening to some early Common the other day, and once again it hit me what a great, great piece of music his breakthrough song was, I Used to Love Her. An acronym not for a woman, but for Hearing Every Rhyme, H-E-R. Basically a four-minute mini-history of hip-hop, in which a young Common is looking at this art form that he so loved, that spoke to him, as he says in the song, since he was 10 years old and woke him up. Now remember, this track was written and recorded in 1994. Hip-hop had just been coming out of its so-called golden age, where it seemed like every album, every single, was fantastic. You had De La Soul, A Tribe Called Quest, Public Enemy, Run DMC, all putting out classic tracks, one after another. And then what Common saw as a fall-off. It went West Coast. It went Hollywood. It went for the money. The gangster rap thing was coming in, and admittedly, some really fine gangster rap tracks, but what he saw was not a good trend. He saw it falling off. So in an extended metaphor, over three verses, like three chapters in a novel, he encapsulates this rise and what he sees as the fall of hip-hop in his relationship with this girl. The girl starts out innocent, wide-eyed. She becomes this Afrocentric philosopher, using the music to express what she feels inside, and then moves out to the West Coast, becomes corrupted, defiled, seduced by the money, losing her original vision. amazingly prescient view of hip-hop. So here he is lamenting the fact that there are no more classic hip-hop tracks anymore, and yet he himself has created a hip-hop classic. It's called I Used to Love Her by Common on Sound Opinions.
I met this girl when I was 10 years old, and what I love most, she had so much soul. She was old school, and I was just a shorty, never knew. Throughout my life, she would be there for me on the regular. Not a church girl, she was secular, not about the money. Those stuff was my checker, but I respected her. She hit me in the heart. A few New York aunts had dinner in the park, but she was there for me, and I was there for her. Pull out a chair for her, turn on the air for her, and just cool out. Cool out and listen to her, sitting on bone, wishing that I could do eventually. If it was meant to be, then it would be, cause we related physically and mentally, and she was fun then. I'd be geeked when she come around. Slim was fresh, Joe, when she was underground, original, pure, untapped her down, sister. Boy, I tell you, I miss her. Yes, yes, y'all, if you don't stop. To the beat, y'all, if you don't stop. Yes, yes, y'all, if you don't stop. A 1-2, y'all, if you don't stop. Yes, yes, y'all, if you don't stop. A confidence, y'all, if you don't stop. Yes, yes, y'all, if you don't stop. You act, yo, we gotta be the sure shot.
Now, periodically, I would see old girl at the club, sit at the house party. She didn't have a body, but she started getting thick quick. Did a couple of videos and became Afrocentric. Out goes the weave, in goes the braised bees medallion. She was on that tip about stopping the violence. About my people, she was teaching me. By not preaching to me, but speaking to me. In a method that was leisurely, so easily I approach. She dug my rap, that's how we got close. But then she broke to the West Coast, and that was cool. Cause around the same time, I went away to school, and I'm a man dub expanded. So why should I stand in her way? She probably get her money in LA, and she did stunt. She got big pub, but what was foul? She said that the pro black was going out of style. She said Afrocentricity was of the past. So she got into R&B, hip house, bass, and jazz. Now black music is black music, and it's all good. I wasn't salty, she was with the boys in the hood. Cause I was new for her, she was becoming well-rounded. I thought it was dope how she was on that freestyle. She was just having fun, not worried about anyone. And you can tell by how he's hung bust. Yes, yes, y'all.
That is Common with I Used to Love H.E.R., Greg Kot's Desert Island Jukebox pick for the week. The Sound Opinions Desert Island Jukebox is supported by Maker's Mark Bourbon. Maker's Mark, it is what it isn't. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, you and I are going to run down our favorite rock duets.
Greg, as always, we have some thank yous to say on the way out. Sound Opinions is produced by the ace team of Robin Lynn, Jason Saldana, with assistance from Annie Minoff. Our intern is Kobe Ashpiss. Bob Mold was recorded by Mary Gaffney. And our fearless leader, our executive producer, is Tori Southside Malatia.
I look at my telephone book, I look at my telephone book, I can't stand away. Look, I hate to think the way you took me down to a burning rage. I wrote your name on every page, you don't return my call.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline, 888-859-1800.
New messages.
Hi, Jim and Greg. This is Travis calling from Oxnard, California. I was listening to your basically half-year review for 2011. A couple of standouts for the year so far that you didn't mention were I'm really enjoying the Wyoak Civilian record, and that title track is just a monster. And also, I'm really enjoying the Rural Alberta Advantages Departing, which came out really early in the year. Both great records. I figured I'd just toss that out there. And, thanks a lot for the podcast. You guys do great work.
Hello, my name is Ken Wadsworth. I'm calling from Shelbyville, Kentucky. I was calling in reference to several programs, specifically the Arcade Fire. It was refreshing to hear a group of musicians that weren't totally stuck on themselves. Also wanted to congratulate you on the best of 2011 so far, but I did see a glaring omission, the latest record from Death Cab for Cutie, Codes and Keys. This band just continually cranks out solid album after solid album. This is three or four in a row. Very tuneful, very melodic, total ear candy. So really appreciate your show and look forward to listening to the podcast. Bye.
She may be young, but she only likes old things. And modern music, it ain't to her taste. She loves the natural light, captured in black and white.
Hi, guys. How you doing? It's me, 12-string Frank, calling again from Staten Island, New York. You know how much I like progressive rock. And just yesterday, July 12th, a new album came out from Yes. And the album is called Fly From Here, and it's got six songs, and one song is in six parts, and it's 20 minutes long. So it's real progressive rock stuff, and the reason I'm calling is I would hope that you guys can review it. I think I'm hoping that you'll give it a buy it. That's what I did. I bought it. If not, a burn it sounds good also. I don't think you'll give it a trash it. It's just too damn good. I was happy that you did trash Bon Iver. I was very happy about that. All right, thanks a lot, guys. Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Rob from Columbus, Ohio, and I was calling about this week's show on Wax Track Records. It was a neat show for me just because of my adolescent fondness for industrial music, Nine Inch Nails, and it was neat to have the mainstream crossover acts be connected to their punk roots. But the thing that I really had to call and talk about was the moment on the show where Chris Connolly was recalling riding a motorcycle down Cortlandt Street in Chicago and seeing all those steel foundries and how that was an inspiration for his famous steel providers. Live in Chicago, and one of my best first memories was being miserable in a rainy fall and riding my bike from Logan Square to where my girlfriend lives in Lincoln Park and being absolutely awestruck and surprised by those same steel foundries on Cortlandt Street, having that connected to sort of classic song and industrial music gave me chills. Just a fun connecting memory for me. Thanks for all the great work. Have a great week.
No more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.